The other part is dehumanization. Certainly, if you think about that man in the arrest, in the trauma room, he, as this conversation is going on, that's dehumanizing for him. And certainly, if you read the stuff about people watching their own arrests, which I used to read when I worked critical care, it sort of curls your hair. You hope they've got some empathy while they're up there watching the team fight it out. It was dehumanizing for him, but also for the nurses involved and also the other team members. What I want to emphasize is don't forget the impact on the physicians, the RT, and the other people in that room as this conflict is happening. We need to move that to a notion of respect. The other thing that is happening is there's a sense in which our problems are getting normalized. And again, I'll use an emergency example because that's where I'm spending most of my time right now. What happened was when we started the study just about 2 years ago, when we started gathering field work or going into the field, we used to get met. People would know us and they'd say, oh, hi, Patty, you're coming on to observe. By the way, we're short two and we've got eight admitted. It was like a mantra, short two nurses, eight admitted patients filling acute care beds. And then what started happening as the time went on, hi, Patty, we're three short and we got 15 admitted. Hi, Patty, we're five short and we got 20, 30, I think 37 was the highest number I've heard recently, admitted. And what starts to happen is people are coping, which is admirable, thank God for that, but it starts to get treated as normal. We take it up as normal. It's not normal. It's completely nuts. It is... It's not normal, and it's not what Canadians want out of healthcare. The research on what Canadians value about healthcare is quite clear. So what we need to do is push back on that. Now, obviously, if you're in there trying to cope with the 30 admitted patients and the two ventilators who can't go to ICU and the fact that you're now putting adults in peds rooms or whatever problems there are, you're having to cope in the moment. So how you are with each other is going to be important. But there needs to be a place, and I know that there's been a great deal of use of PRF forms, professional responsibility forms for that work from the union, to try to flag these issues, document them, and move the normalization to advocacy. And what I want to say is we have to do that as individuals, but also within the entire profession in every arena. Nurses on the front lines of care, union members, the RNABC has a role, although the legislation change is making them on a little bit of shaky ground with their advocacy role right now, which is one of the reasons you don't see them coming forward as much as I think they would want to. Those of us in academia absolutely have to be advocates, and all of us need to pull together to say this is not normal and it's not good, and that we as a collective have the solutions to do something about it. And the other two themes, just to say a little bit, and I'll tell you a bit about what we're working on. I'm going to do blaming last because in some ways it's the most important. The other theme is people are starting to feel disconnected from each other. So you certainly, in that example I read you, have that sense that there's no way that that poor eMERGE nurse is going to look on that ICU nurse as a colleague or somebody to go to and chat with. And it can be that people start to feel disconnected from each other within the overall unit. And a sense of belonging for the kind of teamwork we know is important is going to be crucial. Now, the final one that's actually second to last on the overhead, the one that's getting our attention most right now and that we're particularly concerned about is blaming. My favorite example is the one that just hit the press last week, where Bob Smith, the CEO of the Fraser Authority, got fired because he was blamed for, and this is in the press, got blamed for what had happened within the emergency departments within his health region. And in later interviews after he'd been fired and could therefore speak out, what you heard, now I don't know what was true here, but I can tell you, I followed what was in the press. What the press reported was that he'd actually let the ministry know quite a while ago that they had a serious problem on their hands and had come forward with some solutions. And it's not just the ministry doing this blaming. The blaming happens all the way down the line. So in this example I just gave you, the ICU nurse is blaming the eMERGE nurse for calling what she thought was an inappropriate code, and she's completely wrong on that, but there's this blaming going on. We see managers blaming staff. We also see staff blaming managers. Managers are in a completely no-win position here right now. I think morally it's a very problematic place to be. And we see more experienced nurses and specialty nurses blaming new non-specialty nurses. So that blaming is fueling some of the angst and the resentment that's making it worse. So there, what this means is that if we're going to have, these themes are not necessarily a be-all, end-all, but we see them as a package, and we're trying to strategize on every one of them. So, for example, what we're working to do, and I can't promise we'll be completely effective, but what we're working to do is having regional meetings to do some advocacy work, talking about regional planning for nursing and other resources. We're certainly working on, we've got some workshops with staff planned to look at how people are in relation to each other. Now, you can't sell this to eMERGE nurses as a be nice to each other, right? It's the culture where you don't do that. We'll jazz it up a bit and do case studies and things like that. But certainly it's going to be to help them do the kind of self-reflection that the nurses in our research team have done. We also want to, and in doing that, really want to emphasize that notion of support and belonging. So our strategies are both the structure, what's going on, as well as helping people to think about how they support each other. And those are the strategies that we're working on now, that we will know a little bit better about what's going to work, what won't, and how to plan for the future. The other thing, if we go to the just the final couple of comments I want to make, is that the strategies that we take within our team and that nursing and that you are taking, I find it useful to always think about them happening at least three levels. So there's individual strategies about how we are one-on-one, so that I'm nice to Deborah on that shift that we have together, that I listen to her concerns and so forth, and we find a way for that ICU nurse and that eMERGE nurse to have a different kind of conversation. But we also need to think about some of the organizational strategies that I've got a couple of overheads that I'll go through on, as well as a way of getting the message out politically to larger communities about why nursing is important. And certainly our own well-being is crucial, but the argument we continuously have to emphasize is the link to patient, family, community well-being and what Canadians value in healthcare. So let me just close by saying a couple of things about organizational resources. And one is, if we go to the next overhead, thanks, Melody, it's absolutely clear what nurses need for good quality workplaces from a structural sense. And this is work that's been pioneered out of Health Canada's Office of Nursing Policy. Health Canada itself has published papers on this. The BCNU's got documents on this, the RNABC. We definitely, in the advocacy that I said is important, need to advocate for reasonable workloads, patient-provider relationships, ratios, I should say. Job security, the casualization of nurses remains a huge issue. I'm astonished when my students say to me still that they can't get a full-time position on graduation, which just completely blows my mind. It means somebody's not reading any research data if they're making that kind of decision-making. People need job security, healthy work schedules, feeling safe, valued, and the presence of available leadership. And that means formal leaders who aren't stretched impossibly between multiple agencies. But also what we're understanding in our team is working on leadership from the bottom up. Every staff nurse seeing themselves, whether they're new or old or specialty or non-specialty, seeing themselves as having elements of leadership there. By the way, I presented this list when Roy Romano produced his report in 2002. I presented this list to him and said that there, I said the same thing I've said to you, that I had a chance to present to him on behalf of the UVic School of Nursing. And I said to him what I've said to you, that the research evidence is absolutely clear. It's, you know, very clear that this is what we need to do. And he turned to me, I quite liked him. He turned to me and said, well, if that's the case, why hasn't it been happening? Why has nothing happened? So my answer to him was, and I could just see the light go on in his face, my answer was, it's not about logic, it's about politics. It's about power. So anyway, there's some things that showed up in the Romano report around provider well-being, maybe not as strongly as I would have liked to have seen, but it's still there. And we need to find a way to build alliances to continue to make that possible. And I do want to introduce here the next research study that I'm running off to after this. In order to help some of this happen, we've launched a follow-up policy study where our staff nurses are actually going to be expert advisors to this policy study, where we have every chief nursing officer in BC, Health Canada, the chief of Health Canada's Office of Nursing Policy, some CEOs and policymakers across the country, trying to figure out how do we do this on a bigger picture? How do we take the insights and the wisdom of nurses from the front line of practice and what we know is absolutely true and how do we move that forward. So I do want to say that we're not the only ones doing this kind of work, but we are, I think, the only group trying to add a moral dimension to helping this kind of work come forward. So that certainly gives me hope. And what also gives me hope is the fact that the nurses themselves have learned, we have learned with them, they have learned with us, and they are clear about their own reflection on themselves and what they need in relation to working with others. So I think what I'm going to do is just mention that there's a couple of other overheads there around ideas about relationships. The next one, Melody, just to flash by, because I know you've got it in your handout, is it means nurses also need to be more engaged in policy making than we have been. One of the things that's happened is that many policy decisions have been made without any professional expertise, not just nurses, but medicine, OT, physio, social work, others also have been shut out of a lot of policy decision making to a large extent. And we need to change that with the goal of the last overhead, really building what we're calling relational capacity. So that means our relationship as nurses with each other, with patients, their family members, communities, but also our relationships with the organizations within which we work and the larger social political structures. All of it are areas that we already have strength but need to continue to learn from each other, support each other to make some changes. So what I'd like to do is kind of invite questions or comments on that about the next 10 minutes. And by the way, in ethics and philosophy, you learn you can disagree with each other too. So you can push me on any of these points too if you want, and I won't be offended. Okay, cool.